Session number 11191, Reel 3.
Lynn Pearman, Reel 3. Yes, it was very interesting. You were saying that by the time you'd been in camp some time, psychologically you were becoming adjusted to
yes,
it.
Oh, yes, yes.
And against escape.
Well, I was...
For yourself?
For me, and for many others. We began to look on, towards the end, actually, escape as a slightly odd. Anyway... It was,
is that because you were getting news about the course of the war?
No, it was because in many of us were becoming resigned to the enormous odds against successful escape. And in my case, in the case of several others, we were busy on other things. I began to paint these things, reproductions of paintings of mine. But I'd always been very interested in drawing in ordinary life, but never applied myself. And we had... a set of paints sent out by the YMCA, God bless them, and a few brushes, and the Red Cross sent a few, and we formed art circles. And I began to paint portraits, draw portraits. Not all the time, of course, because we had such interrupted days with roll calls and discomfort and this. But others produced plays. I've got photographs of them. We did them in Summer Night's Dreams and Joan, Hamlet, all the good things. We had Bruce Organ from the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, who was a marvellous director and producer. The Germans flocked in to see the plays we did. These were the happy, the good times. And it was a form of escape. I was Lysander in Midsummer Night's Dream. It was a form of escape. And Horatio in Hamlet. But the painting became very important to me, and reading. And if we had a sort of Sargon University, many people took degree courses in various subjects.
Where did you get the books from? And the
from the Red Cross, bless them.
And could you make sort of requests to them?
Well, we in letters home, we said, could we have this book or that book? But, no. Or yes. I think books were sent in clothing parcels occasionally. The library was not bad. We had a fairly good one at Shubin. In the library, in the actual library of the girls' school. Of course, there was a very strong wire fence all the way round, and we weren't able to use the girls' school except for lectures and reading.
I was wondering also, you mentioned you were 30, at the beginning of the war. Do you think the fact that you were rather more mature...
No.
than some of the others, made this difference? You know, the fact that you adjusted...
Oh, I think so. Because the suicide rate among... there were many attempts at suicide, and some successful, by the young pilots, you see. It was more difficult for a young 21, 22-year-old man to adjust, because his vision, his time of life, his 22 decades... of life didn't give him a broad enough picture. It was 3 decades of life, which gives you a better sense of proportion, that this is only a temporary time, although it might be 3 or 4 years. It's a sum, it'll end one day, if it's only in death. And I suppose, yes, there weren't any serious attempts by 30-year-olds. as I remember. But the potato dump was a favourite place for wrist cutting. Hmm. A man called Michael Roth had a very near... he was nearly gone when they found him. He was a fighter pilot. But they revived him. They found him and revived him. And he lives in Canada now. And has waged a continual war against the War Office for not repaying the money that was deducted from our salaries, wages, salaries, during the war, as prisoners of war. That's been at the core. When you meet Captain Bracken, he has been a leading light in this, a campaign to recover the money that was deducted from officer prisoners of war during their time of captivity. £6, in my case, a month, which was a lot of money in those days. Anyway, it was assembly passed now. But Ruth has been so active all the way from Canada, rather too much, really. Anyway, where did I get to, my dear?
We were talking about your painting.
Yes. You see, there's so
and
many...
I can see if these are evidence, you know, this is superb.
Well,
know,
not really.
The standard and quality.
Yes, I've become a serious painter since I retired. In fact, I'm busier now than I ever was. Portrait painting and things like that. These are two limited editions, I've only just finished them.
And it would seem from what you're saying, you know, there are compensations and everything.
Of course. If I had to live my life again, Lynn, I would choose 2 years of incarceration somewhere. If it were a monastery, it would do. To find myself, to read, to think, not to have to worry about making a living. It's a luxury. Even though the food is poor, you've got the freedom to read War and Peace for the first time. You go through the whole of Tolstoy.
How about your captors, you know, the Germans? You were saying about the Wehrmacht being rather different.
Yeah.
Did you form relationships with the guards?
I formed one in an escape attempt. When I was playing the part of Lysander in the Midsummer Night's Dream, one of the guards took a shine to me. I'm nearly 80 now, but I was reasonably. This was
blue eyes and a blonde.
Oh yes. And he took a shine to me and gave me small concessions. And this was cultivated by us. And when he came to see me in the room, everyone was ordered out by the escape committee so that I could get things off him, you see. And I promised him a happy life after the war and a very big job and a comfortable position. But he wanted some help. We needed watches and compasses and things like that. There's the Midsummer Night's Dream. That's me as Lysander. The nearest one to you.
That's wonderful, isn't
and,
it?
And the fellow walking forwards is Demetrius, who is now a retired tomato grower from Guernsey. We see each other very often, several times a year. And fellow on the extreme left is playing the part of Helena, and he became an admiral. He was fleet admiral.
Well, I can see why he fell for you.
No. There were some very odd types among the Germans. Anyway, we used him, you see, but it fell apart. We got one or two. We did things like that if we could establish a contact with a job. With a German, we'd try and get him into trouble so that we could blackmail him. but it wasn't often possible. And we were forbidden to talk to German guards, rarely, except guards who specifically talked to us.
Well, what were the punishments?
Oh, 14 days in the cooler, 14 days in solitary.
Just for talking to a guard?
Well, not really, no. The guards were under instruction too. No, it was difficult to talk to them. No, if we made an escape attempt, we'd be put inside the cooler for perhaps a month.
Were you there?
I was there for 14 days.
And what was it like being in the cooler?
Actually, I got used to that. Because at least we could read, so the time passed. And in the cooler, we were able to talk to the Germans and listen to their propaganda, how they were going to win the war. There was no question about it. Their spirits were high right to the end. Anyway.
Did you get any hard news, though?
Oh, yes. We had very efficient news from the BBC. We had a wonderful man called Lou Barry in our compound, who was an international oarsman. And he was considerably older than most of us. I think he was about 40 years old there. And he organized the thing called Jimmy Higgins, which was a radio set. We referred to it not as radio, but as Jimmy Higgins, you see, so that no one would know what we were talking about. And Lou Barry actually moved the wall of his room about 1 foot or 9 inches. The whole of the wooden wall was moved to make a bigger space behind it between the next room and there, so that there was ample room for aerials and the construction of Jimmy Higgins, the radio. The valves and things like that were obtained from Germans who were under blackmail by us. Yeah, we'd give them cigarettes and get them into trouble for having the cigarettes under threat. And the threat was very severe, because we could promise any German guard that he would be on the Ostfront against the Russians within a month, unless he did what he told us, what we told him to. And the Ostfront terrified them. Which was a very unpleasant place. Anyway, the days go by.
So you heard this news regularly, did you?
Of course, every day. And every day the newsreader would go from hut to hut, with each hut very carefully guarded by lookouts, and the news was read. We had BBC news every day. We knew where the Russians were, we knew where we were, until June 1944, of course, we were nowhere, except Bomber Command were pounding the daylights out of Germany.
Yes. And well, was that important to your morale, June 1944?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. Particularly the East Front, where we followed. We kept a map, a huge map, and we knew when Stalingrad happened, which was the only time that I really felt that we were going to win the war. Stalingrad, the great Russians. And the Kursk battle, the biggest tank battle that the world has ever seen and is likely to see. So the Russians won. And then we knew the Germans were done for, in spite of their Sondermeldungs, when they had a bit of good news. The Sondermeldungs would come out on the speakers. But we had the real news from the BBC. So, I told you we came back from Shubin to Stellag Luft 3. And by this time, of course, our little group had been formed, which consisted of Tony Barber, Robert Key, Eric Bodman, the Guernsey tomato grower, John Harper. How are we doing? John Harper, Bungie Bracken, who was a senior officer of the Rhone, being lieutenant commander at that time in the Fleet Era, and myself. And we had one or two others who floated in and out from time to time. But and Sidney Smith, who was the Daily Express journalist, he was also of our group. We came back, we formed reformed ourselves in a room, and so life went on. My painting activity became more and more important to me, and reading and play act and producing plays and making the best of it. Escape began, as the months went by, escape possibility diminished with me and with many others. And I say again that this was the first time in my life when I had had time to do some reading and discussion and things which I would never have had an opportunity to do in normal civil life.
Were you ever asked to do work for the Germans?
Never. Officers were not allowed to work.
Did you have other ranks in your main camp? It was all officers.
There was a compound of NCO RAF, but our compound was all officers, and they segregated us. There was no distinction in food or anything like that. But the NCOs were not allowed to work because they were air crew, and had they escaped, they regarded a pilot as being, the Germans regarded a pilot as being worth a company of soldiers, and so it was very important that none of us escaped. I must tell you that when we came back to Stalagluf 3, we had a big tunnel going, which got out 87 people, 87 men. All of them were recaptured in a very short time. And they were brought back, some mainly caught by the Gestapo. And at this time, because of Stalingrad and the fact that they had to bring soldiers back from the East Front to round us up, not me, I was part of the tunnel, but I wasn't one of the escapers. The Germans had to bring some soldiers. Some people said it was a whole division to round us up to make sure that we didn't get away. I can't believe they brought a division back, but there you are. It was certainly a time of disruption for the Germans, and they didn't want it. It was after Stalingrad and after Kursk, and the Russians were beginning to move, and they kept them under close confinement, the 87. They brought 37 back to the camp, and the little Austrian officer who conducted most of our roll calls came in with tears pouring down his face to announce that 50 had been shot by the Gestapo. You've heard of that. Orders issued by Goering, which later at Nuremberg was Goering's undoing. This was a very sad moment. We all stood in silence.
Did you make any form of protest?
The senior officer was demanded an interview with the Oberst, and the Oberst was apologetic. It's not my fault. It was the Gestapo. It was the SS, I think, not the Gestapo. I think it was the SS who did it. Anyway, it was a very black mark.
I was wondering, towards the end, when you knew, post-Stalingrad, which would have been, 1943, wouldn't it?
Stalingrad was January 43.
Yes. And then after D-Day in June 44, what your expectations were, you know, feeling that the war was going to be won by the Allies.
Oh, yeah.
Did you worry about your situation and what might happen to you?
No.
Did you think the Germans would sort of...
Well, this was a salutary experience, the fact that 50 of us had been shot in cold blood. This gave us a warning that we were in the hands of not very nice people. Tough. I respect the Germans for a great many things, but their ruthlessness in war is a very tough experience. And we would have had a terrible struggle to beat them were it not for the Russians. It was a Russian war, really. I'd regard it as a Russian war. 20 million they lost. Must never forget that. And we began... We were always fairly light. We had each other. Our spirits were engendered by each other. We had lots in common. We had lots of jokes. We wrestled. We played volleyball. It was not too bad. The wooden horse was in our compound. The wooden horse escape, which was the one successful escape from our place. Oliver Philpott, Michael Codner, and Bill Williams. And we vaulted over the horse every day in different places, but we laughed at them, you'll never get it, you'll never make it. But here goes, we'll do the vaulting, we'll do the carrying, and good luck to you. And they got out, and they all got home.
Yes, that's a very celebratory
and Oliver Philpott,
escape, isn't it? Yes. When you see the film, you know, for instance, there have been several of the various events you've described. You know, I wonder how you react to them.
Oh,
you think that they're pretty faithful, or do they romanticise it?
They romanticise and they Americanise it, particularly The Great Escape. That was the escape where 50 were shot. But it's Americanised with... Steve McQueen and on a motorbike and one or two Americans. There were no Americans in that Great Escape at all. In fact, the Americans... the Americans began to pour in, of course, after 1943-44. And we had quite a lot of them. Not with us, but in a separate... at Stalingrad 3, but in another compound. There were about 8,000 altogether. So we came to the ghastly time when 50 were shot, and the invasion began, and Bungie Bracken went mad. He ran round the camp. They've landed! We knew before the Germans announced it. And the invasion took place in 1944, June the 6th. And time went on. But the Russians still pounding away.
What stage did you go on your long march?
Were
you
right. Now, I've been able to find one or two... I was able to keep one or two notes of that, but unfortunately, because of the roughness, I couldn't continue it, because I lost... our first warning... was on the night of the 27th of January, 45, at 8 p.m., that something was going to be done about moving us. We had a fellow called Birdie Barrett, who was a great ornithologist, and he got hold of this information from somewhere. Anyway, he shouted out to all of us, "Prepare to depart. We're going to leave within the hour." And we didn't know. We thought he didn't know what he was talking about. But eventually, the Germans got us out at 3 o'clock in the morning to count us. And we began to form up outside Stalingrad 3 at 7 a.m. And the snow was up to our knees at this time. We had, in the few hours we'd been given notice, some of us had been able to make sleds out of bedboards and things like that, with good runners that would go on the snow. And we piled these sleds with Red Cross parcels. The Germans threw open the Red Cross doors. They said we were going to have to march west for many days. because the Russians were only a little way away, and we could hear the artillery. Anyway, we did this, and we set off in fine style at 7 a.m. I think at this point there are about 6,000 or 7,000 of us lined up, and we split off into groups. Some went north, northwest, some went southwest, I think, but we, our little group, almost dead west. We were about 1,200 or 1,500 of us in this small group. And we began marching, and I remember Tony Barber, who, he was one of our group, he was about 23, I think, at the time. But he made a very good deal with a German woman and gave her a Red Cross parcel for a perambulator, which he used as a means of conveying extra parcels and clothing. We tore a strip off him for that. And Bungie and I, who were more or less the bosses of the group, we told him what an idiot he was to be so spendthrift with our precious parcels. And within 3 miles, the perambulator had collapsed. We had a lot of laughs and recriminations about that. Now, we started marching, and Sydney Smith joined us. And all was going well. We did 18 kilometres, and we reached a town called Halbau, H-A-L-B-A-U, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There were 1,200 of us. The whole 1,200 of us waited outside a school for 3 hours before we were packed inside for the night. And we were packed in at about 80 men to a classroom. And others were sleeping on the stairs and in the passages of the school. There was no heat, but we were all fairly tough. And on Tuesday the 30th, at 7 a.m., we began to march again. And we arrived after 17 kilometres at about 1:30 in the afternoon at a place called Sichdichfür, S-I-C-H-D-U-I-C-H-F-U-R. 17 kilometres, and there we waited for about 4 hours in the road, and we are packed into the loft of a school very, very tightly. And others were crowded into a small Roman Catholic church. And one or two, unfortunately, were left outside all night. We couldn't squeeze them in. And on Wednesday, we stayed there one night, and we commenced marching at 6:15 in the morning on Wednesday the 31st of January. And we were in the dark. It was cold, very cold indeed, and snowing very heavily. All our feet were wet from the day before, and we kept going all day. We completed a distance of 40 kilometres. And we arrived at a place called Muskau, M-U-S-K-A-U, at about 6 p.m., and we were housed in a glass factory for the night. And it was the most luxurious physical experience because the glass factory was being used as a glass factory. We watched the German workmen blowing their glass. And it was fascinating to watch. And we were luxuriating in the warmth of the furnaces. We're fairly comfortable there. And we stayed there until Friday the 2nd. It gave us a bit of strength. And we commenced marching at 12 noon. But tragedy of tragedies, all our sleds were useless because the snow was beginning to disappear and become soft and not hard enough to use sleds on. We turned our sled into a cart with some wheels that we found, and that made some progress for us. And this gave out after a few miles. The wheels began to come off, and also a small kinder cart, which was bought from children. We did it again, and that collapsed. We did 21 kilometres, and we reached a small farm between 7 and 8 o'clock in the evening, and we sleep the night in a barn. And here I have the squitters, which I should know about that. So my spirits were getting a bit crushed now, because it was I couldn't eat anything. But it didn't seem to matter much. We stayed there, that's right, in the second...